We want to make a correction to our last show. The term croft is not interchangeable with croft house, and we'll fix it in future episodes. If you want to find more about crofting, please head to crofting.scotland.gov.uk. Thanks to those who got in touch. I'm Peter Gilchrist, and I'm a food writer.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton, and I am a food historian.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We're going to be talking to historians, producers, and some all-round great Scots to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're jumping into an era that redefined the very notion of Scottish food.
Kicking off with a focus on a very special time of year.
It's a very Victorian Scottish Christmas. Horse and carriage. Can you hear the gas lighting? a fire crackling. The jovial sounds of crowds and entertaining outside. Perhaps carol singers.
Carol singers, you say?
Carol singers. Well, that can only mean one thing. Christmas has come to town. That was just a cheesy introduction, but we're gonna. If there's not a time for cheese at Christmas, when is there time for cheese?
Exactly. Both literally and figuratively.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But today we're going to be talking about Christmas in the town, Christmas in the city. Obviously, in the last episode, we talked about Christmas in the croft.
Yes, very different, very rural. No chance of gaslighting in the croft.
Except for perhaps in a very toxic relationship between husband and wife.
You would hope not. You would hope everything was rosy and peaceful in the countryside.
That's
yes.
The picture we are painted. But into the city, into the town, in places like Edinburgh, Glasgow, Dundee, we have, in the Victorian era, small hamlets are transformed into economic powerhouses. Mm. And there's a lot more money coming around in Scotland.
Yep.
Now, there is disparity. Not everyone is getting wealthier.
No,
lots of people
not.
Are working in factories.
Yes.
But there is an opportunity. If you have money, if you have a little seed money, or you have a great idea that people are beginning to buy in bulk. The kind of technological advancements in mass manufacturing means that if you have a great recipe, you might be able to start a food brand, a biscuit brand.
Yes.
And along with that comes new opportunities for fancy houses.
Exactly. Consumerism takes on a sort of new face in the Victorian period, particularly in towns and cities where, you know, we begin to source our food from different places. You have more shops available to you, shops selling those branded products.
Mm.
And there's the opportunity, if you do have that little bit of extra disposable income, to spend it on Christmas.
Mm.
So this is a really interesting time because you have the start of things like turkey clubs or Christmas clubs, where you would sort of put a wee bit of money away every month, every time you get paid. And we still see them, in circulation today in some effect. I think this is maybe the first time in that sort of urban commercial setting where Christmas begins to look like how we understand it now.
And I had read that one of the biggest kind of organising forces in turkey clubs and Christmas clubs was actually pubs.
They were interesting.
A central kind of savings bank where you would also get, you would save up for your turkey and with it you would get gin, a bottle of gin that we supplied.
Now that's a good deal.
For a turkey club. I mean, I think there was a big pushback against pubs providing this kind of service because Christmas was seen as beginning to be seen as something moral.
Yes.
It was something that was seen as being a time to be your best self, and your best self can't exist next to a bottle of gin.
Yes. No, you're probably
right. I'm probably quite right. Shall we have another quick drink?
I know. Clinking the glasses. The ice cubes.
You can't be your best self on a drink. Most people that are moving from a croft are not moving into a townhouse.
No.
In Edinburgh.
No. Because you have big shifts, you know, from the 18th into the 19th century around how cities like Edinburgh and Glasgow are, you know, functioning. Previously, in the centre of a place like Edinburgh, what we now think of as the old town, that would have been the hub of all activity. That would have been where merchants were living. Then over the course of the 18th century, lots of money comes to Scotland because of things like slavery.
Mm.
And the new town gets established in Edinburgh. We have all these Georgian houses coming available, wider streets, bigger rooms, cleaner. And then the old town, the sort of class of the population of the old town starts dropping. That property becomes far more crowded. You know, housing is very densely populated. So there's an interesting shift by the time we get to the Victorian period in how our cities are actually laid out.
How is a townhouse different from a croft? Let me count the ways.
Well, I mean, interesting. Yeah. My vision of a townhouse is semi-detached or attached,
mm-hmm.
potentially, not always. Multiple floors, that's a big difference. You probably don't have your cows in the bottom of your townhouse yes. either. I mean, maybe, you never know.
I think we can categorically say there was no cows in the living room in Edinburgh.
No, something had to go very, very wrong if that had happened.
Find a cow dung in your front hall.
You would probably have, you would definitely have more specialised space for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be a kitchen. There would be probably a pantry, a cellar, a cold room or a cold store. So you could store your dairy and your meat in somewhere with like thicker walls that didn't get as, so it didn't get as hot. So the way that space, you know, people are starting to put their elbows out, enjoy stretching compared to being stuck in a wee pokey croft. Mm. Townhouses were more flashy. It was more about separating space, so there was different space for different activities, so that some space was public and some space was private. I think that's a big difference. You know, there were parts of your house that were specifically meant for entertaining, and there were parts of your house that no one but you and perhaps your servants would see if you were affluent enough to be able to afford.
And you might also have gardeners.
Yes.
Gardeners that will bring in your evergreens.
Mm-hmm.
Cooks that prepare your special festive menus, working with the lady of the house,
yep.
the angel of the house.
The angel of the house.
And so can we see any differences between the way that a croft was decorated and a townhouse?
I think so, yes, definitely. So, you know, last episode we discussed things like the solstice and the fact that that had influenced decorations. You would have a lot of greenery. That's still going on in your townhouse. But there's probably more of it. Some of the decorations start being perhaps a little bit more what we would recognise as Christmassy now.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of candles, Christmas crackers, things like that. Ribbons, tinsel, shiny things. Things that are sort of explicitly, seriously decorative rather than necessarily just brought in from the garden.
Yeah. Another thing that we have in Edinburgh in the 19th century is we have the first Christmas shop that opens in Edinburgh.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
No, it was a special pop-up and mm-hmm. it was, there's advertisements for it in the British newspaper archive
mm.
and they talk about the very best of Italian and French decorations in both glass and paper mache.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about having sweets.
Yes.
A big kind of focus on Chinese sweets, Chinese sweetmeats.
Interesting, yeah.
And different kind of fondants and things.
Mm.
But it's set up as a Christmas showroom in the centre of Edinburgh, affixed onto an Italian furniture warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the first times where we begin to see, in Scotland at least, Christmas trees
yes.
being advertised and decorations for Christmas trees being advertised. At the same time where we see these growing cities and people becoming more and more impacted by the views we're seeing in newspapers of Queen Victoria mm. and her husband.
Yes.
And the kind of the ideal Christmas. People are now looking for a place to be able to emulate that picture. Where can I purchase? Where can I buy?
Exactly. And we spoke in the first episode about the 19th century being a time where print culture explodes. And with that was the rise of advertising, the rise of branding. So for the first time, you are probably looking at catalogues, looking at adverts in newspapers, thinking, oh, I want to buy that. And one thing the Victorians were very good at was tying brands or tying images or tying ideals to famous people. So as an example, I mean, he was a romantic author rather than a Victorian, but Byron was such a prevalent image, and people used him to sell anything. You want to sell something, stick Byron's face on it, to the point where there was Byron shoe polish.
Amazing.
Yeah. So when it came to Christmas, the royal family, Queen Victoria, she and they become the perfect face of Christmas. And we also touched previously upon Albert and his influence. So you have the Germanic influence of the Christmas tree, them all gathered around the Christmas tree. It's sort of starting to sell this kind of cookie cutter image of what the ideal Christmas should look like.
But also in the same year, we see Prince Albert and his tree.
Mm.
In newspapers, we also see notes of German immigrants that are having Christmas tree brought into their house.
Ah.
So, of course, it's always influenced from the top.
Yes, of course.
But it's not solely about Prince Albert.
No.
We actually see immigrants coming into this country, bringing parts of their culture with them,
mm-hmm.
in the same way that the Vikings did, in the same way that the Christians did. Cultures mm-hmm. arrive here, bring little bits and pieces with them of mm-hmm. their own culture, and we wait for someone at the top to take hold and for it to spread like wildfire.
Exactly. You need that sort of, from the top trendsetter.
Yeah. The other interesting thing that we see in Scotland around Christmas trees is that it was actually at charity bazaars, fundraising mm. bazaars, for the first time a lot of people would have seen a dressed Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, bazaars and kind of big charitable events tended to be hosted by very influential, affluential people from your local area.
Yes.
And they were trying to emulate the royal household.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're investing in bringing in big Christmas trees to be the centre of the stage.
Mm.
And you see bazaars being marketed at this time as the delicacies and dainties of so-and-so and Mrs. Harris's fantastic knits.
Yeah.
Around the stupendous, gloriously dressed, glittering Christmas tree.
Mm.
Come along to see it.
Yes, it's about the spectacle.
Mm.
It's about being part of a cultural movement, but also being drawn to that because it was still quite new and shiny, literally.
It's not, we've not come that far away from it.
No,
it was something to see in the Victorian era.
Mm.
But even despite the fact that we all now have Christmas trees in our homes,
mm.
we will go and see a Christmas light switch on.
Yeah.
And I think it's that moment for Christmas, for me, it's all about, we're always trying to recreate that moment of like childhood, undiluted joy.
Yes.
There's moments in our childhood where the Christmas tree lights turn on
mm.
or we were given a gift.
Mm-hmm.
There's like that combination of surprise and delight which imprints on us as children.
Mm-hmm.
And we chase that and we try to emulate that for other people.
Mm. The early influence is there. Evergreens is part of Yule decoration. Juniper, holly, ivy, mistletoe. That's been in place for hundreds of years. But I love the idea of literally being like, nope, it's not enough.
No.
We now need to take an actual tree inside.
I think, but it's like the ornamentation of the Victorian era,
mm.
people were obsessed with colour and intricate design.
Yes.
And like vibrancy.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing a tree decorated, nothing that would have looked short of a jewellery box of sparkling, dangling glass, hand-blown shapes and toys and
edible things.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, silver tinsel, candles, which to me always seems a bit worrying. But.
Yeah. I want to get them this year and give them a try.
Oh God. So in addition to the Christmas tree, there are some other very familiar things to us now that would have been in the Victorian Christmas townhouse.
Yes.
Including things like Christmas cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of looking up Victorian Christmas cards, but if not, do. They are so funny. They are so strange. They always feature strange, slightly alien-looking characters, sometimes vegetables, sometimes babies, animals, doing quite sinister things sometimes. Christmas puddings, scary, terrifying Christmas puddings.
Yeah.
I've never thought of a Christmas pudding as a nightmarish entity until I saw a Victorian Christmas card.
There is an entire culture in the Victorian era of Christmas puddings being evil creatures. Part of it is because people weren't used to eating that level of like rich food
yes.
at Christmas. And there's throughout, again, kind of newspapers in the Victorian era, we see accounts of people talking about children becoming very ill following Christmas Day.
Mm.
Children getting like gastritis and because they're just eating too much. And it's that
yes.
kind of slight ward against them being a glutton. But the kind of the running kind of image that you have is having nightmares for weeks after having too much Christmas pudding.
Too much Christmas pudding.
And this evolves into cartoons of Christmas puddings chasing children with knives and things as a way to ward them off eating too much.
Love it. I love that. But yes, Christmas crackers as well. We mentioned them. They are a Victorian innovation.
Yes. But originally packaging for sweets.
Yes, sweets rather than any kind of joke or...
Yeah. And it was a confectioner. Mm-hmm. Apparently he was inspired by the sound of a log falling off his fire that created a crackle.
Ah.
And there was a surprise fun. For him. Yeah. And that apparently, the story goes, is what gave him the idea for the Christmas cracker.
Mm.
Now, it was his son that began to put in, who took over the business, and he began to put in the jokes and the party hats.
Yeah.
And they began to sell like wildfire. Mm. I mean, really so. They don't have them in America.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm going to generalize every single citizen in America has ever had a kind of party cracker. But it's not a common place over there to have a Christmas cracker on Christmas Day. It's very much a British notion. And I think as well, because crackers really missed that Dickensian like influence of Christmas, it was just after the beginning of Christmas and that culture and Queen Victoria and things, where obviously things like the tree and the turkey and the goose and these sorts of images became a global representation for what Christmas should be.
Mm-hmm.
Crackers were not that.
No.
But I have a question, a cracker question for you.
Oh, yes.
Do you peel your cracker before or after dinner?
Before.
Right. I'm before as well.
Because then you can wear the hat all through dinner.
Right. So, but I asked this on my Instagram last year.
Uh-huh.
It was about 50-50.
No way.
Yes. Of people. I will say, I think the people on the wrong side of history, I think it was largely English.
Right.
I think there's a north-south divide on Christmas crackers.
That's so strange. I can't. So it's just sitting on the table while you eat your dinner?
I think you have, I mean, I don't know the mechanics
Please
of it.
Please don't tell me you don't even have them on the table at all and you bring them out afterwards.
I think you take them out afterwards for cheese and coffee and or some nonsense.
That sounds diabolical.
But they were saying you put it on and then you're playing your games and you're having fun. Sounds terribly middle class in English.
I mean, yeah, like what about the hat? You want to be wearing this the hat all the way through
and
the meal.
What do you talk about during soup?
Yeah.
If not the terrible
awful
jokes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh. That's wrong.
I think so.
Okay. Yeah, you heard it here first. Cracker before dinner. Always.
That's the Scottish way.
That's the Scottish way. We say with no authority behind that, but we're giving it to ourselves.
My one Instagram poll and our very strong instincts on Christmas crackers.
So yeah, you have around you the kind of trimmings of Christmas that we now just take as commonplace. And I think in some ways, and well, I know in some ways that is also true of the food that you would be eating in your fancy townhouse Victorian Christmas. So we've mentioned Dickens, and his influence cannot be understated, both in Britain generally, but also in Scotland.
Yeah. And perhaps the stipulation is his influence in Scotland, it is focused on... It's not focused on rural Scotland and it's not focused on people living in crofts.
Mm.
It's focused on people that are living in cities that are perhaps doing slightly better and that can afford, number one, that can read.
Yes.
That can lean into that world, that literary world and get lost in imagination and can afford magazines to look at pictures and begin to get wrapped up in this idea of Christmas. But Dickens did do tours in Scotland and readings of A Christmas Carol that were well attended.
Oh yeah, massively. And again, you know, from the traditions there, but also the food. You know, he mentions turkey. There's that famous turkey scene where the turkey's bigger than Tiny Tim. And
it's not that hard. He's a malnourished boy in 1820. Like,
yeah, I mean, we're not going off much here. Yeah. It has to be said. But that becomes the sort of iconic image of Christmas dinner. Whereas, you know, turkey would have been eaten before Dickens, but I think that becomes the moment where it overtakes perhaps eating a goose or beef.
Yeah.
You know, a ham.
I'm going to call it a story in folklore, and it's spoken about, it's in a textbook, and it circles around the rise of King James from Scotland to England and his first Christmas. Now, at the time when King James ascended to the English throne after having been King of Scotland, the trend in the court for Christmas is to serve a whole pig. Mm-hmm. Now, you do have big, long Christmas tables that are covered in every single kind of meat.
Anything you could shoot anything and roast.
Anything that had wings was put next to another thing with wings, inside another thing with wings. Russian dolls of poultry covered in pastry.
Yes.
But there had to be a star of the show, and at that time, the star was a whole pig. Mm. Now, James had been educated in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And in Scotland, there is, and still is today in many parts of Scotland, mysticism around eating pigs, around eating pork. Mm-hmm. It's seen as something quite dirty. It seems quite unlucky. There's some notions that it might be because pigs eat acorns, which were sacred to, which obviously are from oak trees. Oak trees were sacred in kind of druid religions.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Which obviously, and they were the main ones that celebrated solstice, and so eating pigs around that time, very bad, very unlucky. Pigs also thrive in societies where there's food waste.
Yes.
Not necessarily Scotland.
No.
In any era, to be perfectly honest, before this one.
And pigs were expensive to keep as well. And unlike a sheep or a goat or a cow, you don't get byproducts from pigs other than the pork.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good for consuming your food waste if you're lucky enough to have it. Yeah. But you can't, well, maybe you can. I don't know. You don't milk a pig.
You heard it here first. I didn't know what you were going to say. That was the last.
No.
Anyway, King James comes to the throne, and he doesn't want to serve pig to his guests. He doesn't want that to be the star of the show. So, a few monarchs previous, King Henry VIII had apparently been serving these new bejeweled chickens that had come out of the New World. Mm. And his advisor says to him, you should serve, that should be the star of the show, this new bejeweled chicken, which is a turkey.
A bejeweled chicken.
I think because of the neck.
Yes.
And the kind of terribly ugly face that turkeys have.
Yeah.
They called it bejeweled. And at the time, they were slightly more elegant creatures.
Upselling.
Upselling this bejeweled chicken. But anyway, so he then decides he's going to serve that and publicly calls it the king of the birds, a bird for kings. Mm. And this is a time where we begin to see turkey take over.
Yep.
From it being a slightly left field, new world food.
Bejeweled.
Bejeweled chicken.
A bedazzled chicken.
To becoming something that is served for Christmas. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have a guest on our podcast this evening. I asked her to write a couple of sentences, but as a recent PhD graduate, she wrote me a soliloquy about...
He's also looking, Peter's looking at me very pointedly as well.
Because like as another person with a PhD, it's entirely jealousy that I don't have a PhD. Macon McCormack is a historian of Macon, which began with an interest in art historical practice. I can't read. When studying medieval embroideries and women's work, she became interested in brewing and distilling history. Her PhD thesis at Glasgow University examined the global success of the Scotch whiskey industry using advertisements as evidence to illustrate development and change from 1890 to 1970. This research documents the cultural transformation of Scotch whiskey as a national drink and a global spirit, emphasising its identity as a cultural object, but also as a complex industry with competing brand identities. Welcome to the floor.
Hi, Macon
McCormack.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. I want to get us kicked off. Now, we are asking people about what was the first food that you remember growing up that you were given the responsibility of making? And maybe we'll narrow this a little more. Is there anything that you were in charge of making at Christmas?
Yes. So Christmas cookies were something that my Midwestern grandmother would make. And so as children, we were put on the kitchen stool at the counter and given the Christmas sprinkles to, I think what they're sugar crystals. They're not sprinkles like you would get here. What do you call those? 1,000s or something?
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
And I tried to replicate that here as that sort of American diaspora at Christmas and realized our sugar crystals are highly illegal in the UK. Yes,
they have scary, scary E numbers in them.
Yes.
Never did us any harm.
So a little bit different, but yes, sugar cookies were the kind of gateway into a love of food and tradition and baking.
Did you have the apron that was like tied, like doubled over and then tied up really high and then like tied around your waist sitting on the bar stool? That's what I have a memory of just like this like apron I was wearing as a tube top, essentially.
Love it. What an image. Yeah, no, I mean, mine was quite similar, actually. For us, it was mince pies, and it was always my dad's job to make the mince pies, and he used to make the pastry. And then I have two younger brothers, so we would be put in this sort of conveyor belt of activity where one of us would be sort of cookie-cuttering out the bases, one of us would be doing the tops, one of us would be putting in the spoonful of mincemeat, and it sort of became, Christmas conveyor belt of activity.
So, in this podcast, we're going to be looking at Victorian Christmas in Scotland. And I think part of that has to include whiskey, right? What was happening in whiskey during the Victorian era?
Oh my gosh, a massive transformation. You've got all kinds of things happening from the growth of distilleries, the advent of blending whiskeys, so taking a very kind of fiery, high alcohol spirit off of pot stills and combining it with a grain spirit that was a lot cheaper to produce. Mm. So you blend them together and you get something a little bit more easy on the palate. And then you have the kind of movement out of Scotland. So taking the cue from Queen Victoria and all things Scottish and from Balmoral. And you have this kind of move to accept Scotch whiskey, which is just whiskey when it's in Scotland, but taking this kind of fire water and going out of Scotland and saying, okay, what makes this uniquely Scottish and why should other people who are not necessarily Scottish drink it?
Mm.
So obviously a lot of your research focuses on advertisements. So I'm wondering, A, what are we seeing in advertisements around whiskey? And do you know if whiskey became a popular Christmas gift around the world or in Scotland?
Yes. So I was looking at some interesting things when in my PhD thesis specifically, I'm looking a lot at pictorial advertisements.
Mm.
So you don't really get Christmas themed advertisements until the 1930s. And you've got these great big kind of flashy, colorful, full-page advertisements from brands like Johnny Walker and Doers. And it's all very kind of advent of advertising, saying, you know, don't forget, you know, a case for Christmas and these sorts of things. But there is an earlier association. When you first get advertisements for whiskey down in London by some of the larger wine and spirits companies, it's in a classified format, but it's part of a Christmas hamper. So they're saying, this is essential to your Christmas soiree. You have to have these sorts of things, you know, a little champagne, a little brandy, but don't forget the Scotch whiskey as well.
That's really interesting. And I mean, so I've been reading about when these drinks would be tied into festive traditions. And one of the things around Hogmanay would have been first footing and the idea that you don't, the person who is first across your door needs to have a bottle of something with them, some bread, some cheese, something to sort of offer to eat and drink to make sure that your year was going to be full of food. And I just assumed that that bottle was whiskey, but maybe that was wrong. I don't know.
I would say it's probably likely to have been whiskey, but again, there was a lot of change happening and it was becoming much more accessible to get, you know, you could get rum from Jamaica, you could get champagne and you could get whiskey. What I found interesting for comparing advertisements actually in Scotland. So for people here, it is just whiskey. You don't necessarily need to distinguish that it's Scotch. But you do also have the competition of Irish whiskey. So that's where the distinction becomes important. And that's part of the advertising is they would distinguish what place it was from.
Mm.
But I found that in the kind of like mid-century, you're getting advertisements for whiskey as part of a toddy.
Yes.
And so this is what you need. It's not necessarily for Christmas, but it is for health reasons as a toddy. And with that, I also found it interesting within December advertisements, you're having these advertised on pages alongside grocers who are selling things like, you know, raw and refined sugar, black and green teas, roasted coffee, but also currants and figs and plums and all of these things that we associate with Christmas finery and part of that celebration. So alongside it. So to me, in my mind, that makes me go, oh, well, these are associated.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that sort of warming side of things. Bacon, do you, as a whiskey expert and a drinks expert, have a particular favorite Christmas tipple?
Oh, well, I'm not shy about having a whiskey.
I would be disappointed
if you
were. It'd be terrible
if you were like, I'm actually not really into whiskey.
I really don't like it, yeah. It's just got fun advertisements.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. You know, I do quite like... of mulled cider, to be fair.
I have another question, Macon. Christmas crackers. Have you ever had a Christmas cracker in America?
No, because from what I understand, if you try to take them back through airport security,
gunpowder,
they have the little cracker pop things.
I got ID'd.
No,
buying crackers.
How old do you need to be to buy a cracker?
I think it's challenge 25 and I was having a particularly good skin day.
Glowing.
But I mean, there are dangerous weapons. Now, when you're having your Christmas cracker, I assume you have a Christmas cracker now living in Scotland.
I do. I have to have the crown.
You yes, have exactly. to. Do you open them before or after dinner?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's sift back. I would say I've been to other people's houses who have had them before so that you get into the festive spirit. There's a little bit of like, I think, blues Christmas song in the background.
Yeah.
And put a crown on and enjoy dinner. But I would say I think maybe my Scottish in-laws are a bit shy about it. So they're not really that excited about popping the crackers and getting the crowns on. So that tends to wait until after dinner.
We had a hypothesis at the beginning of this, which you were ruining. This is a fly in our data set, Macon.
Yep.
Because we were trying to say that the Christmas cracker after dinner is a very English thing. Your families aren't not English, are they?
No.
Right. Well, that hypothesis is ruined. Thanks very much, Macon. So we've talked around the Christmas feast.
Yes.
But let's dive in. So what are we eating for Christmas dinner?
So I think in this period, talking about our sort of wealthier middle class Victorian family, we're starting off, there's going to be different courses.
Right.
You've moved away from having all the food out on the table to having course by course.
Mm-hmm.
First course is probably going to be something like a soup. Some kind of soup, maybe some fish.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen Christmas menus, Scottish Christmas menus that have oyster soup as a starter.
Wow.
And in the Victorian period, you have an interesting shift with things like oysters, where previously, in previous centuries, they had been the food of the poor because they were, let's face it, not overly appetizing. Like, I love oysters, but when you actually consider what it is and how it looks, and it's not, you know, it used to be very much you lived by the sea, this is what you ate because they were there in abundance.
Also, local history facts. Paisley was initially founded because as a place it had moisture lands, pasture lands for farming, but also the white cart that runs through the town was an oyster bed.
Oh, wow.
And there was a supply of fresh oysters.
That's amazing.
Fresh river oysters.
So oysters used to be very much the food of even the poor, people who lived on the coast.
By the white cart.
Or by the white cart. Oh. Oops. But something shifts where basically someone decided overnight that they were kind of trendy and should be put in this fancy place in the menu.
Is it maybe that move towards that French style of cooking and serving food?
Exactly. And then within a number of years, like a really short number of years, considering how sustainable oyster populations used to be, they just get completely over-harvested. And then they are the preserve of the wealthy because they become expensive because there's less oysters. So your oyster soup, you might have a sort of consommé. You know, there's a big French influence on food always, but especially through the Victorian era, and almost arguably, especially in Scotland because of the old alliance.
Mm.
So it was not unusual at all to see bills of fare or menus written almost entirely in French because it was the done thing.
And for listeners, the old alliance is essentially an alliance that has existed between Scotland and France.
And it's specifically Scotland and France against England.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
But it includes things like our armies fighting together. It includes our people being educated in each other's countries. We see a lot of French cooking. We see a lot of the kind of French patisserie comes into our Scottish bakeries. We also have things like the influences, like the French influences of food. So there's a hypothesis that our dedication to morning rolls is actually a throwback to the kind of petit déjeuner of a French breakfast, which is a hot drink, a coffee, and a small baguette.
A small baked good.
Un petit baguette. we are officially at the end of my French.
But no, so there's...
Je raison.
Yeah, get you back on Duolingo. No, there's an interesting tradition as well in the 19th century for sort of national, like, art, nationalistic art, to use food as a depiction of where people stood. So... Mm. Magazines, Victorian magazines like Punch, which was a comedy magazine all about illustrations, would quite often depict Great Britain as this really greedy character that was just like stuffing its face. It was all about the empire, kind of a critique of the empire almost, but food was always it was always used to showcase nationalistic tendencies.
Right.
And in some earlier 18th century art, you would have the kind of English, there's a painting, I think it's Hogarth, it's called The Gate of Calais in France. And it's, you've got the gate coming down in this kind of like threatening way. There is a British chef who is fighting some French Navy people over like a massive hunk of beef. So it's like, le rose beef, which is what French people used to call English people to make fun of them because all they ate was roast beef. Mm. And then in the corner, you have this sad little Jacobite who is really malnourished in comparison to the fat English chef who's got an onion in his hand. And it's like, well, that's all the Scottish people got because they sided with the French, not the English. Right. So food runs through all of this. But by the 19th century, we're like, oh, actually, French food's fancy. So that's going to influence our menus. So I'm thinking, yes, soup, seafood, fish as a beginning of our Christmas feast.
And now when we're thinking about going into the main courses, obviously it has many courses, but what is the star of the show in an upper class Victorian house?
I mean, it goes without saying, perhaps, that it's meat of some kind.
Yeah.
And probably, if you could afford it, a really big turkey. For your Dickensian Christmas, postcard Christmas.
Because geese had been incredibly popular.
Yes.
And in fact, for centuries before, were the most popular bird to have.
Mm.
But after King James comes to the throne, there is this push for turkey. And goose begins to slide away from being something of the upper classes down to something slightly lower middle class.
Yep.
And then to something for poor people.
Yeah, which is so strange because, you know, now goose is so expensive.
Goose is so expensive now.
I love goose. I think it's far more delicious than turkey.
Thank you to Gressingham Duck for sponsoring our last photo shoot.
Yes, where we created a beautiful Victorian feast.
Yeah.
And we had a lovely goose. And you stuffed the goose.
I did.
So you used a recipe, I believe, from a Victorian, well, 19th century Scottish cookbook.
Yeah. So I found this book. The reason I had zoned in on it was, one, it was Victorian, and two, it was printed in Paisley. And
love.
Growing up in Paisley, I had not really thought of Paisley as being a centre for food innovation, nor for exquisite food publishing.
Mm.
But this this writer, Jenny Wren, which you suggested to me might be a fake name.
It feels very fake to me, but we'll continue.
Very common. She wrote a couple of books. She was a journalist, or wrote an advice column, or whoever she was wrote an advice column. in a Glasgow newspaper, and there's a book that she wrote on cooking big joints of meat. And I thought, what a better way to dive into some Victorian Christmas cooking.
I mean, that is the whole point of a Victorian middle-class Christmas, big joints of meat.
Big joints of meat. And so the goose she advises to stuff with breadcrumbs, with goose liver. I used duck liver because it didn't have the goose ones to hand. It was in that terrible packet, but I couldn't tell what was what.
Ah, yes. The mixed bag.
The mixed bag.
The gizzard mix.
There was like four things that I thought could be in the liver, but I'm not going to risk it.
Just chop them up real small.
Yeah. But I had duck liver to hand and with sage and onion.
Yum.
And then it's stuffed in and cooked. It does smell lovely. Not a massive fan of liver, not going to lie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I quite like liver.
But the thing I hadn't, as someone who does not frequently cook goose, the amount of fat that comes off a goose. I mean, it was like a bar of soap trying to get it out the bag it came in. and then wrestling it into a tray. But alas, it does, it cooks beautifully. And you had kind of said, it's not like turkey, which has light meat and dark meat and dry bits and wet bits.
Mm.
wet bits.
Sorry. Some wet turkey, please.
Some wet turkey. The entire of a goose is wet.
Yeah.
It's all dark meat.
It's not quite gamey, but almost there.
Yeah.
And I think, it's just delicious.
But also, so in that Jenny Wren book, she goes through how to cook a turkey and to how to cook some big beef joints.
You would probably have beef as well.
Yeah.
You might have some mutton, a ham.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing about beef as well, I mean, again, we're talking about in the city, but if you were someone who lived in a big town, or if you were someone who owned land, a crofter might be paying you for their rent in the year with a big old side of beef.
Yes.
The very best quality, because that was the way to get the most amount of money for your rent. So especially in Scotland, where like rearing fat cattle is, we are prolific cattle farmers.
There is a bronze statue of an Aberdeen Angus bull in the town that I went to school in. And every year at Christmas, someone paints his bollocks gold. And then they get returned to their normal bronze. He's called Jeremy. Jeremy the bull.
Sorry.
I don't know. No one knows.
Is this... How long does... Hold... I can't... But it's... Sorry.
For the festive period.
But how long does that... Did that start in the 90s?
I have absolutely no idea. I hope so.
How old is Jeremy number one? And how long have people been painting his balls?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I will find out.
Anyway, back to Jenny Wren.
But that's not in our cookbook.
No.
No.
But of course, so beef being something that was prized on a dinner table.
Yes.
And of course, ham and things like that. And there's also some fantastic sides. So what I have seen is that in the upper class cookery books, so I'm thinking about like the Jenny Wren cookery book is kind of like a middle class book.
Yeah.
When you're looking at things like Williamson's, which is a book that was made, it was in a school in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And they're really more focused on like high French dining. They're training chefs that are working in high class hotels, people that are working for the upper echelons. Not a great deal of roast ties or mash.
No.
You know, and when they've got the at the back of the Williamson's, they've got kind of menu ideas and they have 1,001 different birds and pheasants.
Yes.
But everything is served with like chestnut sauce.
Yep.
Or it's served with very delicate, light, dainty drizzle over on a bed of.
Yep.
But none of it is substantial.
No, it's all decorative. It's dainty. You're right. Yeah.
And I suppose as well in Scotland, while we're not known for the potato famine because it obviously had a much bigger impact on Irish history, Irish culture, Irish life. We had the same famine that existed in the Highlands, which was one of the big kind of contributors to the clearances.
What then became the clearances,
And I suppose, you know, kind of dying potatoes is still fresh in people's minds.
Well, there's a interesting, like, cultural snobbery around potatoes in the late 18th, early 19th century. You have, and this is not in a Scottish context necessarily, but writers like William Cobbett, who wrote books including Cottage Economy. And his whole thing was like, okay, we need to return to the nostalgia of Britain past because people lived better back then. And it was incredibly rose-tinted and not very accurate, but he also published Rural Rides, where he went all around England trying to like understand how people who in Scotland, they would have been, it would have been about crofters, right?
Yeah.
And he, this man hates potatoes with an absolute vengeance. To him, it's like animal food. It's like pigs eat potatoes. People shouldn't. If you're eating potatoes, there should be the amount of shame he sort of puts on people. And it's because of those associations with poverty and scarcity, but also the fact that it was, you know, kind of an animal food. And it's really interesting how even in the early 19th century, potatoes just, yeah, some people absolutely derided them.
And we see the same thing in turnips, actually.
Yep.
Because what we consider a turnip now, a Swedish turnip,
yep.
A yellow, very hard root vegetable. Is it a root vegetable?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
Was actually originally animal feed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
exactly.
It replaced at the time, which was these very light, delicate turnips that we would now kind of think about as being quite English.
Yes.
Small, snowball type things.
Interesting. Like some of the earliest recipes I found for actual turnips, and I think it was maybe Scottish, I can't remember. Like you would eat them raw, like a sort of dainty little salad.
Or candied turnips.
Yes.
Well, maybe we should try it.
Yeah, I mean, don't knock it. To me, like, because I grew up very rurally, the smell of turnips, like neeps.
Yeah.
Was like you were walking past a field where a lorry full of them had been dumped out by the farmer and the sheep were eating them. So it was, it's still like to me, I like neeps and tatties.
Yeah.
But it's ever so slightly sheepy.
Right, okay.
There's a farm.
I don't know what to take with that. I don't know where to go next. But maybe it'll be back to sides. So one of the things that I'm really interested in when I was reading about these menus was the presence of cauliflower cheese as a Christmas dish.
Delicious. Who doesn't love cauliflower? Even if you don't like cauliflower cheese is beautiful thing.
I always thought it was a very modern invention.
Mm.
Alas, no.
It seems like the kind of thing that would be like American and...
Yeah.
Yeah, like 20th century.
Actually, something slightly... It feels slightly 70s when you're eating it because it's kind of just like floating in sauce.
Mm.
But actually, and the construction of a cauliflower cheese in the Victorian era was slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And the recipe in both Williamson's and Jenny Wren's, it calls for the whole cauliflower to be boiled.
Okay.
As a full stock. Which I think I might carry forward because it looks quite magnificent.
It does look beautiful.
Yeah. And then you take it out and you cover it with Parmesan. Any cheese, but Parmesan is preferred.
Yeah.
And then melted butter is poured over it.
Yeah.
And then you add breadcrumbs and more cheese.
And do you bake it after that or?
Well, thank you for asking.
You're very
because well. It asks for a salamander to be taken over. Can you explain to the people what a salamander is, Lindsay?
Well, it's a kind of wee lizard. No. So a salamander would...
Are you sure you have a PhD?
So a salamander is something that you would find by a hearth or a fire or a range in a 19th century kitchen and earlier. And it's basically a you would heat it on the fire. It was kind of like a sort of almost looked like a griddle. Or a grill, a kind of, I don't know how to describe the shape, like flat. You would heat it in the fire and then you would sort of almost use it as a grill. It was like a portable grill. And I imagine for your cauliflower cheese, you would get it really hot in the fire. You would then hold it over your cauliflower cheese. So you get that nice like crisping effect.
Yeah. I mean, I use a grill.
Yes, I mean, that's fair enough.
But I think essentially it's a metal rod that heats up.
Yeah.
It's the same technology.
Yes.
I just pay more for it.
It is. And a grill doesn't sound as cool as a salamander.
No. Can you fetch the salamander to finish my cauliflower cheese? And alongside that, you have carrots, you have parsnips, you have things like cabbage gratin.
Red cabbage, yep. Cabbage gratin.
Lots of red cabbage. I really do enjoy... in Victorian cooking, how they preserve the whole vegetable, the whole food.
Mm-hmm.
Things are brought looking like they should look
and
coming out the ground.
And not only that, but things were made to look like that were not that. So
right.
You have, and we'll maybe move on to this when we discuss puddings. But
we're at the end of sides, let's
go into puddings. So your pudding might very well be an ice cream that was shaped to look like a bunch of asparagus.
Right.
Because what's funner than ice cream if you can make it? And by this point, if you had disposable income, you could make it because you had the introduction of bits of food technology like ice caves or ice, like hand turned ice cream machines, which you would fill. They would sort of be half barrel type looking things, round, with a kind of metal inner case where you would put your custard, your fruit ice. Sometimes had a water base, but typically it was like a cream, and round the outside you would pack it with ice and salt. So the 19th century is the first point in time where like buying ice becomes possible.
Right.
So instead of ice being something that you could only have if you had enough land to have an ice house, because it was literally like shipped over.
Right.
Now ice can be stored, technologically ice can be stored in much bigger quantities, so you could actually buy ice. So for the first time, the sort of upper and middle classes can make ice cream in the home using these things. And it was all the rage to shape your ice cream so that it was looked like anything but ice cream. It looked like a bird's nest. It looked like asparagus. It looked like, a bunch of carrots.
Mm.
So your dessert might also look like your side dishes.
I just got an ice cream mold.
Oh, fun.
It's not a carrot.
Oh,
but
sad.
It is a sort of something slightly phallic.
Look. Okay. Yeah, they were often quite phallic, to be fair. But you could also, by this point in the, so we're talking maybe 1850s onwards, you could buy food colorings that you could use in the home. So right. Then you can turn your asparagus ice cream green.
Well, onto food colorings and trifle with dessert.
Delicious.
Absolutely delicious, but also sometimes deadly.
Yes.
One of the most popular colorants, food colorants in the early Victorian era was Shales Green.
Mm.
What was the main ingredient in that, Lindsay?
Well, the main ingredient in Shales Green was arsenic.
Wow.
Yeah. Really delicious, lovely, healthy arsenic.
This is what happens when two food historians know the same fact.
We're bouncing off each other.
I've been talking for so long.
It's so spontaneous. arsenic, which, as listeners should hopefully know, is not something that you should imbibe.
No. But at the time, so if you don't know, arsenic is a poison. If you ever watched like a 1990s Miss Marple Poirot.
Yes, Murder, She Wrote.
All of it like was that. About, yeah, it tastes like bitter almonds. I only know that because so many people were poisoned by it and they said it tasted like bitter almonds. Anyway, every time I had an almond slice, I was always slightly scared that someone was poisoning
especially
me.
Especially if it was green.
Especially. So they had this Shales Green was a bright, vibrant green colour, and the Victorians were obsessed with the colour green. It was in their homewares, it was in their wallpaper. A lot of that is to do with gas lighting. Suddenly people were able to see in the evening.
You really like the colour green.
Yeah.
No. We mean literal lighting achieved by gas in the home.
Yes. So they were able to see in the evening, where before you might have had oil lamps, you might have had candles. Suddenly the new middle class, the new upper echelons are able to afford gas lighting, and they can have highly decorated patterns and lots of vibrant colours, and this transfers to the dinner table. Unfortunately, people hadn't gathered that arsenic was incredibly poisonous, and the reason they didn't understand was because arsenic poisoning and cholera have very similar symptoms.
Yeah, okay.
And so for decades, people were being poisoned by their dinner hosts, and everyone thought they were catching cholera.
Oh, that's just such an unhappy state of affairs.
Isn't it just?
Yeah.
But anyway, if you're having a trifle and you can avoid the arsenic, you might have a calf's foot jelly.
Yum.
And a custard.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, by the end of the Victorian era, we start to have things like ready-made custard powder.
Yes. Bird's custard powder.
Custard powder. But of course, a blancmange.
A blancmange. I don't think anyone eats blancmange these days.
I don't, but it's so gorgeous. I'm surprised. Like, protein bowls are disgusting.
Yes.
Yogurt bowls are disgusting.
Huel.
What? Why would anyone decide to eat huel over edible
over actual food?
I think it's time for a blancmange to make a comeback. It could be packed with more flavour. For sure.
Yes.
But for anyone that's wondering, there will be a video playing over this. If you want to have a look at what a blancmange is, head to Tenement Kitchen on Instagram and you can see.
It's in all its pink, lovely glory.
It's like a kind of a milky jelly. That's a really terrible, disgusting way of explaining it, but that's essentially what it is.
It's like, yeah, so the liquid base is dairy milk, yeah, rather than like a clear water jelly.
Yes. But this is my first time making a blancmange, I will say. And we have spoken a little bit about the angel of the house.
Yes.
Something that, and the angel of the house is essentially this idea that came through the Victorian era that women had to create a home, they had to act a certain way,
yeah,
they had to imbue good attitudes and make the right choices.
The phrase was coined by, in a poem, I believe, by Coventry Patmore, that sort of depicted this stunning light-haired woman, because the Victorians had a big thing about the colour of your hair depicting your morals. So in any sensation fiction book, in any sort of big juicy drama romance novel, any sort of slightly seductive evil woman.
Was she redhead?
No, brunette.
Oh.
She could have been a redhead, but your sort of innocent sweet maiden with the stunning morals was always blonde.
The redhead was probably the scullery maid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The three-toed, one-eyed scullery maid.
Exactly. And, you know, the hairs on her wart were red as well.
Right,
you know.
Yeah, of course.
So, no, the angel of the house, this sort of, it came from literature, but it very quickly became a kind of moral standpoint where, yes, you're a beautiful, thin woman who'd never thought an impure thought in her whole existence,
yeah,
would run her home in, yeah, like a ship.
Now, I have never made blancmange before.
Was this you entering your angel of the house era?
Well, I wasn't, because I was in a rush and I was up until 5:30 in the morning making and baking and dressing for this food shoot.
Yeah.
And I was trying to rush the process of making a blancmange. Blancmange, before it's cooked, is a non-Newtonian fluid where if you add force to it, it pushes back against you, it turns rock hard.
Okay.
It forces you to stir it slowly so you can incorporate it.
So this is really not one for rushing.
No. But in the moment where I'm thinking about the attitudes of the Victorian women, that women are encouraged to be kind and graceful and rise above, and in an era where this dessert reigns supreme,
mm-hmm,
I wonder if it's because you have to chill.
You cannot make a blancmange if you're angry.
No, if you're going to make a blancmange, it forces you to be very, very slow, or it pushes back against you. Making a blancmange, the act itself,
mm-hmm,
is something that's very demure.
Yes, very mindful.
Very mindful.
The angel of the house was very, very demure.
Very mindful.
Cutesy.
Not a massive flavour payoff.
No.
But visually stunning.
Visually stunning. And it's interesting. So I did a project about invalid recipes in this period. And milk jelly, which is essentially a blancmange, perhaps with slightly less sugar in it, was something you'd give to sick people. So you basically just bump a wee bit more sugar in your blancmange, some more food colouring potentially, and that's your fancy dessert.
Now, I think we should talk a wee bit more about desserts, but I think we've got an expert calling.
We do have an expert
calling. Did you hear that?
Dr. Neil Buttery.
Is that the phone?
Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
What actually is happening in a wealthy Edinburgh mansion, if they're trying to emulate the British Empire and they're trying to emulate Queen Victoria and what she's serving, what are they going to be serving for dessert? What puddings are they going to have on offer?
Well, you're right. There certainly is a lot of emulation. When you do look in those earliest recipes, you know, from Scotland, which are kind of 18th century, which is surprisingly late. I'm assuming there's lots of older handwritten stuff.
Yeah, there's lots of manuscript collections from like royal houses and noble houses,
which are digitized, but you have to look through pages and pages of dirty handwriting.
Very, very hard to read.
Very, very hard to read.
Man,
although you do get a bit
like
recipe book eyes, where after take 10 minutes of reading, you start to be able to understand what people are, what they're saying. But yeah, so what's happening in a refined house in Edinburgh?
So there are, you know, a high proportion of things that you might associate with England. So, you know, almond puddings are very popular. Like you said, trifles and syllabubs and those sorts of really creamy desserts. Mm-hmm. You've got the really, well, whether you count this as a pudding or not, I don't know. But because, of course, things are getting sweeter. So you've got jellies.
Yeah.
You might have ices. Mm-hmm. Mm. And this is really is moving towards the actual dessert course.
Yes.
Now. You had this strange effect, you know, towards the end of the Victorian period. It wasn't something that just happened immediately. It took a long time to change. That's the change from the old French service to the Russian service, going from having all the foods on the table at once and you could just pick whatever you wanted, mm-hmm. moving to all these courses where you basically got what you were given, mm-hmm. whether you liked it or not.
Yeah.
And then people were a bit confused about it because they'd have like 20 courses because they wanted to make sure everything was included. But anyway, this is where you get the detachment of the puddings from the meat because things start off, you know, all meaty and then get sweeter as you move. You're heading towards the dessert, so it makes sense to be going in the sweet direction. Yeah. So, again, like chromatography, you get the pudding and the meat separating out.
Mm. Yeah.
See you later.
Yeah.
considering the sugar trade in Scotland and as well things like golden syrup, obviously,
yes.
Coming from Greenock, we begin to see the palate of Scotland get much, much sweeter. Very last question. Mm-hmm. Do you open your Christmas crackers before or after dinner?
Before, I think.
Absolutely shut to hell. Yeah.
I did an Instagram poll last year asking because I'd got into a bit of a spat with someone on Instagram saying, do you open your crackers before or after dinner? And it was a half and half. And my hypothesis was, I think there's a north-south divide where, and maybe there is still a north-south divide.
Actually, Meghan opens theirs after.
The royal
north. I wouldn't be surprised if it's not a class thing. Because I'm not railing against the middle classes. I'm from a working class family too. But one thing I've noticed, and I could be completely wrong, this just might be my prejudices, but
this is a place for working for middle class prejudices.
Middle classes and upwards, they don't open their Christmas presents. Literally, we would run downstairs and tear. We didn't even look at the tags to see what things were for. It was just manic. And then I have friends who are like, "Oh no, we don't open our presents till after about dinner." Like, what?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm middle class.
I would have gone nuts as a child.
I wasn't going to say. There's one of us in the room.
Speak quietly. No, I mean. We crackers before dinner, presents as soon as is acceptable. Yeah. I remember getting up at 4 a.m. and being like, and my parents being really annoyed.
Mm. Oh, well, that's my theory gone there. I just kind of thought, you know, presents early.
But you know, she's middle class because she's from the north. So
yeah.
She's from buttery country.
I am. I'm an honorary buttery.
Now, listen, Neil, thank you very much for coming along and speaking to us today. We're going to be on podcast, we're going to be recording next week.
Yes.
That's right.
I don't know when it's airing, but...
It will be airing quite soon.
And where can everyone find you?
You can find me in lots of different places. The main place is my website / blog, which is britishfoodhistory.com. You can sort of find links to
does what it says in the
from
tin.
There. It yeah. does. Hence the British Food History Podcast. I can't think of titles.
But why?
I don't do that. I can't do
you them. Want people to Google you and find what they want.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, listen.
Exactly.
You have a very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
You too.
Bye for now.
Bye bye.
It's time for another Christmas cracker.
Another Christmas cracker. Are you ready?
Yep.
Will I do the joke this
time?
Yeah,
you do the joke this time.
What do you think of the woman with a past?
I don't know. What do you think of the woman with
a past? At Christmas, she is likely to be won by a man with a present. Their joke was obviously past and present.
Yeah.
But today, a woman with a past is someone who...
of a salacious history.
Who put it about a bit.
Yeah.
And a man with a present. Anyway.
Yeah, moving on.
The Victorian... the... right. The Victorianism of the day is afternoonified.
Okay.
Do you know what this is?
No.
Right. Can you have a guess? If someone is afternoonified, what does it mean?
I think it means that they are tired.
Good guess. Very, very, very false.
Okay.
The afternoonified is tied to the idea of afternoon tea.
Oh.
Someone who was afternoonified was someone who was a bit posh.
Okay.
Someone who has become posh.
Right.
Like the
they
advent.
Become afternoonified.
They are someone who begins to serve afternoon tea in their house and are therefore afternoonified.
That's a good one. I like
that. I think I like to think I'm afternoonified. I'm not, but I like to think it.
Okay.
You're proper afternoonified.
I'm just afternoon.
I'm just
there's
after.
No, there's no if I
I'm just
about
trying
it.
To get through to noon. I'm just after.
Join us next week for a look at the crescendo of the Scottish festive season, Hugmany. This podcast was hosted by Peter Gilchrist and Dr. Lindsay Middleton. The sound engineer was Curtis Campbell at Studio 23. This episode was produced by Tenement Kitchen. To find out more information, please email hello@tenementkitchen.com.